There are rules, but each one unfolds differently. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. We're learning more about how the solar system is arranged all the time, but how it formed is still not completely understood. The big picture is known, collapse under gravity from a nebula of gas and dust. But there are a lot of details to be worked out in how the system overall organizes itself, and how individual planetary bodies form. Dr. Hilke Schlichting is an assistant professor of planetary sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and this process of planet formation is among her areas of research. She has investigated the problem in a variety of settings and with a variety of techniques, and her work covers the full range of topics from planet formation and solar system dynamics to the study of extrasolar planets. To do that, she's had to build a career in planetary science, and that too is a process whose details can be hard to predict. Western World's Tony Martinez spoke to Dr. Schlichting about how to build solar systems and how she built a career studying them.
Well, welcome, Hilke, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background. I understand you did your undergraduate work at Cambridge, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I was an undergrad in Cambridge, and I focused on theoretical physics and mathematics. I realized that doing experiments was way too difficult, and I always loved mathematics, so I really found my big passion in theoretical physics.
Which college were you at?
I was at Newhall, which actually was an all-girls college, but it has changed names since I graduated, actually. So it's now called Murray Edwards College.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting because I grew up in Germany, and when I lived in Germany, I also went to an all-girls school, so I always wondered if that had some impact on my on my career and development or not.
And did you start getting interested in astrophysics while you were at Cambridge?
Yeah, I think I've been interested in astrophysics, like, I think forever. I think maybe even all kids at some level are interested in astrophysics, well, at least in looking up into the sky, and wondering where we come from. And I guess I've always been interested in it, but I never truly thought you could have a career in it. But when I was in Cambridge, I realized I really, truly love physics and solving problems, and I really wanted to do a PhD. And, well, I decided if you do a PhD, it better be in something that you're truly passionate about and truly interested in, because if it's not for your own interest and passion, there's probably not much reason to do it. And so then I decided to go to grad school in astrophysics.
And that's when you went to Caltech?
Yes, that's right.
And so what was the topic, and who did you work with there?
Yeah, so I worked with Ram Sari. He was my PhD advisor, and he is a faculty jointly both in the astronomy department and in the planetary science department. And the topic of my thesis was different things on planet formation and also the Kuiper Belt. So it was different theory projects related to the formation of planets and then an observation project, yeah.
How did you find the process in going through a PhD? Was it a very stressful one? Was it a difficult or was it one that just went very smoothly for you?
Yeah, so I think I still believe until this day that doing the PhD was the hardest thing I have done. And I think I had a fantastic advisor. He's very encouraging. He was very much fun to work with. It was really great learning from him and working with him. I really valued that very much. And it's shaped me very strongly as a scientist. I think it's challenging because it's a pretty long time, typically 5 years. It's quite a long time, especially at that time in your life. And I think it's challenging because you have to learn so many new things. You're kind of new in a field. You feel like everybody is an expert but you, especially at the beginning. And I think for me, some of the challenges were that my PhD advisor, he moved back to Israel halfway through my PhD. So after 3 years, I wasn't advisor-less, but, you know, he was no longer at Caltech. So at times, you know, I felt a bit isolated, or I felt there was not really really other people I could have the same kind of scientific discussions with. And so I think for me, that was maybe the biggest challenge, to make that work, to call him and to visit him frequently enough. I think it was a good test, though, because it also kind of showed, you know, how determined I was to really make it work and happen.
Yeah. Right, so clearly it was a successful experience, and then you came to Canada.
Yes.
You came to CEDA.
Yeah, that's right.
So how was that? How did that work for you?
Yeah, that was great. I had a really fun year at CEDA. I think for many people it's a pretty big transition from being a grad student to being a postdoc, especially if you have an independent fellowship and you're free to do what you want, because suddenly you're on your own, or like you have all the responsibility yourself to figure out what's a good project to work on and how to do it. I think for me maybe the change was less big because my advisor was not that much around during the last 2 years of my PhD, so it wasn't quite as extreme. Nonetheless, it was a significant change. But it was good. It was fun. I enjoyed my year at CEDA very much.
So by that time, you're really focusing on Kuiper Belt objects, planetary formation, exoplanets, or mostly solar system?
At this time, I was still mostly working on the solar system.
Hmm. And so after that year, that's when you went to UCLA, I think.
That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
So what were you doing there?
So, yeah. So I received actually a Hubble Fellowship while I was at CETA, in that I took that to UCLA, which enabled me to work with Dave Jewett, who discovered the Kuiper Belt together with Jane Liu. And it also allowed me, in my specific case, to actually live in the same place as my husband again. And so I think that's, you know, one of the challenges I think that many of us have in academia, the two-body problem, and trying to have a career but, you know, not having to sacrifice your personal life entirely. And so getting this fellowship was really fantastic, so not only professionally but also on a personal level. So when I moved to UCLA, I had really a really nice time. For the first time, I was actually in an Earth and Space Science department, because I had all my training until then in physics and astronomy and astrophysics. And that was very interesting for me, because suddenly I got to interact with a lot of people with very different backgrounds. And I think it enriched the way I think about planet formation and my research in general.
A few years at UCLA, and now you're an assistant professor at MIT.
That's correct.
That's a rapid change, isn't it? Or how difficult has it been to adapt to being a professor?
Yeah. So I was told by one of my colleagues when I arrived that the transition from being a postdoc to being a professor, it's like a phase transition. And I think she was right. but I've been incredibly busy, and I've never worked so much in my entire life. But it's been really a lot of fun and extremely rewarding. So I really enjoy the teaching. The students are absolutely fantastic. And so they make all the hard work very worthwhile.
And so now you're building up a group, and you've got a research group with you. And how are you finding that's the supervision of other researchers? Are you enjoying that?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting kind of being on the other side, you know. Until then, I have always been like the student, and now suddenly I'm the advisor.
Right.
But so it's been good. It's been fun. So I have three graduate students now, and so my group has been growing rather rapidly. And we had our first paper out with my first student, so that was kind of, you know, a milestone for me personally. Yeah, it's been fun. It's different. It's a lot of joy kind of explaining physical concepts and thinking with my students about problems and how we can solve them and approach them. And it's also interesting for me to see the different strengths and weaknesses of my students, and some are particularly good at data analysis and some are really good at thinking about physics in a certain way. So it's very interesting to see, you know, how different they are, and, you know, in trying to find projects that really maximizes their strength.
Well, there are so many problems and unresolved issues with the formation of planetary systems. if you were able to choose, and so sometime in the future, you and your group managed to solve one of those major issues, what would it be that you'd really like to focus on? What would be your focus?
That's an excellent question. I think the ultimate aim, I think, is really to come up with a comprehensive theory of planet formation, you know, that really fits together what we know from exoplanets and our solar system and other observations. But I think for now, our immediate goal, our short-term goal, is really, I think what we really would like to understand is the formation of this new class of planets that has been discovered mainly by the Kepler satellite, which is a NASA mission that has discovered more than 3,000 planetary candidates. And most of the planets it has found, there are this peculiar class of planets that we don't really have in our own solar system. So these are bodies that are bigger, typically in radius than the Earth, and smaller than Neptune, but their orbits are typically well inside the orbit of Mercury, which is our closest planet to the Sun. So we have these pretty big planets, but very close to their host stars. So understanding how they're formed, I think that would be it.
So these are the super-Earths?
Yeah, we call them super-Earths and mini-Neptunes.
Right.
Which maybe is not the best terminology, but that's, yeah, what they're called, super-Earths and mini-Neptunes.
And we also have some hot Jupiters that are different to what we knew before, exoplanets.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, so we really didn't know about any hot... We didn't knew about Jupiters, but no hot Jupiters. That's right. Yeah, so, you know, I think we should be really grateful for the existence of hot Jupiters, because if it hadn't been for hot Jupiters, the whole field of exoplanets would not be where it is today. And that's simply because these were the first planets that were discovered, were the hot Jupiters. And the only reason why we could have discovered any planets whatsoever were because of the existence of hot Jupiters, because we would have never been able to discover anything like our own solar system. And so the whole field kind of was only possible and exploded because of the existence of these peculiar planets. So it's very interesting, actually, how this all came about.
So what you were describing, when you described your studies of the Kuiper Belt objects, is the idea that the initial debris disk that could have led to our solar system could have had very similar properties to the Kuiper Belt object, but was just depleted by the formation of the planets inside, say, Neptune's orbit? Is that the picture that we could have in our minds?
Well, I think that I think in the Kuiper Belt we may still have essentially these planetesimals that formed the planets, these building blocks, which have undergone some growth, but they never formed a full planet. Whereas elsewhere in the solar system, I think we had the same kind of planetesimal population like we have in the Kuiper Belt today, only there they accumulated to grow into full planets. So they actually grew, they continued to grow to form something like the Earth.
Should we have a different formation process for the terrestrial planets as for the gas giants? Or are they likely to have a similar source, but then because of the evolution of the atmospheres and the loss of the gases and the low mass components, you'd end up with terrestrial planets? I mean, how do we picture how our solar system grew?
Yeah, excellent question. So I think the formation process of terrestrial planets and the core of Jupiter probably was very similar. So the accretion of a core of a rocky object. But I think what happened for Jupiter was that it was able to form fast enough that you formed a large enough core while there was still gas around, or a lot of gas. So it could actually accrete this gas as an atmosphere, as a big envelope. And which we think was not the case for the terrestrial planets. So they actually took longer to form than Jupiter, which might seem surprising to you. But we have to remember that Jupiter is this sweet spot because it's far enough, it's outside the ice line. So it's a special spot in the solar system where water would exist as ice. So you suddenly have more solid material from which you can actually grow a planetary core. And therefore you may be able to form, specifically at the location of Jupiter, a core fast enough to still accrete the gas from the disk, that would otherwise dissipate in a few million years. And then we think the terrestrial planets actually took longer to form.
For the case of the hot Jupiters, wouldn't we expect them to lose their gas because of where they are?
Yes, and we do actually, some of them that are very close, we actually do see, or we have very good observation evidence for loss of the envelopes.
A big diversity of scenarios, so for the either separate formation because of the conditions, or a separate evolution after formation. So there's still a big diversity in how we could describe the formation of planets and
yes, I think
types.
One thing we know for sure, well, first of all, yeah, so nature is much more diverse and creative than I think we have thought from what we knew about planet formation before. And I think what's very clear is that there seem to have been a lot of motion and reshuffling after formation. For example, the hot Jupiters, I think, are a good example. It's extremely unlikely that they're formed where we see them today because they're so close. As you said, so for example, even accreting that gas envelope, you know, you expect it to to lose them.
Mm.
So, and also there probably wasn't even enough material to form them where you see them today. So they are almost certainly formed further away and then reached, you know, their very close location to their host stars after formation or towards the end of their formation. Which is quite different from our solar system. We, you know, in our own solar system, we know from the Kuiper belt, actually, from the resonance structure, that Neptune must have migrated outward several AU to capture all these bodies in resonance. But that's very little motion and migration compared to what we see for the extrasolar planets. So much more reshuffling.
It could be that a number of people who are interested in the solar system and formation may have this question, and I'd be interested to know what their opinion is. The approximate pattern in the distances of the planets, you know, the Titius-Bode relation, is that some kind of resonance that is set up? What do you think that might be, or is it just something that may not be significant?
Well, I think it's significant. My guess is that it's most likely determined by a stability criterion. So if you try to pack things more densely, more closely, it probably would be unstable on long time scale. So my guess is that a lot of the final appearance of planetary systems is actually just determined by what's a final stable state dynamically. So, you know, that no two planets are so close that they strongly gravitationally perturb each other. And if there was a state like that, I think they would excite each other's eccentricities and have a collision or eject one of the bodies, but and then settle back to a more dynamically stable system. So that's my guess.
Okay, thank you. Another thing that I wanted to comment and ask you about, I was very impressed when you gave your talk, how you combined an analytical approach, pencil and paper, with numerical simulations and observation. I don't know if I've seen this before in a talk. Normally people are comfortable in one area, and that pretty much covers the spectrum of research that you've described yourself as a theoretician, but you're obviously very comfortable with observations and getting observations directly and doing both analytical and numerical work. How did that come about, and is that something that you've maybe has been, is it your personal interests, how you were formed, your professional formation, how did that come about? And I wonder if you'd like to comment on that.
Yeah, I think it's just driven by my own curiosity. So what the skills I learn and what I do is very much driven by what I'm scientifically curious about. And I try to just go for it and try to solve the problem that I want to solve. So if that means that I have to reduce data, or if that means I have to learn some computing language to write some more complicated piece of code, I try to just do it rather than say, well, okay, I don't know how to do it. So I try to really let my research interests drive that and try to keep developing new skills. For me, the most important thing is to really understand the physics and try to understand things at a very basic level. So I do care about the analytic, simple models and understanding that part very well. But then, of course, you want to go a step further and confirm that and validate this with more complicated codes and models. And, you know, I think for me, theory is only as good as you can make predictions for observations. And then, if ideally, you can test it yourself with data. So, yeah, for me, they all belong together. But, yeah, the reason that I personally developed in this way is really, it was driven by my scientific curiosity and the problems I wanted to address and work on.
Just wonder, before we close the interview, if there's any words of advice you might like to offer for young students, people who are thinking of going into area research. And I don't know if there may be some thoughts on, you commented early in the interview about how perhaps having gone to a girls' school and then to a girls' college helped you develop your scientific aspect. And I don't know if there's any insights and advice you might give others as to how to choose their path, you know, when they're making very difficult decisions. I don't know if you'd like to share anything on those topics.
Yeah, well, I guess it's probably hard to give general advice.
Mm.
But I guess for me, I've always tried to do the things that I deeply enjoy doing and care about and are passionate about, even though it may not have seemed like a good, like necessarily a good choice or the obvious choice to other people. So people thought it was a little bit strange that I really was so passionate about physics, because it's, people would say, oh, but that's not typical for a woman. I don't think that's even true, but it's just, you know, often perceptions of society or even, you know, other generations. And yeah, and I think, you know, I encourage people to really be bold to try to find their own way in life. You know, I think there's no mold we have to fit in. We should try. I mean, I think once you really figure out what you really want to do, then I would just try to go for it. For me, I think personally, it was the worst thing for me has always been not trying. As long as I try, it's okay to fail. But having not tried would be much worse for me than having failed at something that I tried. So I think for me, that has been a very, that determined my path very strongly. So I would say, you know, if you really care about it, give it a try, because you don't know how far you can go until you try.
Well, thank you, Helga, so much for being with us, and have a good trip back home.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion.
Well, Tony, what did you think of that?
It was such an enjoyable interview. Hilke's very sweet, very professional, very dedicated, and I enjoyed hearing about her development. And I think students in the field of physics and astronomy would be very encouraged to hear how her life developed. There's a number of grad students here, and I was encouraged when she said that doing her doctorate was the hardest thing that she'd ever done. But then later she did say that becoming a prof was like a phase transition.
Yeah.
So I guess that was tough too.
Exactly. These are all things we get to look forward to, I guess.
I know. Going into middle school wasn't that easy. But really dedicated to this idea of trying to understand planetary formation. And so it led her to Kuiper Belt objects as the remnants of the formation of planets, and then from that study of the solar system, and then of course exoplanets, which she's done so much work. And the whole idea is to really develop a good idea. And it's really quite impressive. She appears so young, and to already be a professor, have her own graduate students, be leading a successful research group. It really shows when you have talent and enthusiasm, you can really go far very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's... yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying there is totally true, and it's clear, you can see from what she's doing and all the responsibilities she has, and clearly this is somebody with a lot of passion and also a lot of talent, especially in this field, and the field that she's now in is a very exciting field. There's a lot of undiscovered country there. And so there's a lot of room there for talented people who think outside the box. And I think it's clear that she's a person who really was perhaps unlike a lot of her peers. I mean, she mentioned that she's always loved math, she's always loved physics. She was able to really pursue that in her early career. And perhaps that's not something that she saw a lot of where she was. So she found herself perhaps not in the mainstream of wherever she was. So it's good to see that somebody who goes after what they love rather than what they think they should do or what they think is expected of them to do, that you can be very successful in that. I think that there's not enough emphasis on that kind of mentality.
One of the things that I found interesting was the comment she made about her education and having been educated in girl-only schools, and the college that she went to for her undergraduate degree was also a girls' college, and how that, because of that, there would have been no gender bias, any preference, or any, she wouldn't have been discouraged or felt discouraged because there were fewer girls and boys doing the physics or the math. And I think we probably still have a fair way to go. You know, clearly, the rights are there for everyone, but I'm pretty sure if you look in your engineering courses, it's probably nowhere near half and half. And even in physics, it's getting closer, maybe.
In the sciences, they're a little bit more balanced than they were.
Mm-hmm.
In physical sciences especially. I think in things like, in areas like biology, perhaps there has been a higher proportion of women there. But yeah, in engineering, I think there's still, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a pressure, but I think that it's, for whatever reason, it's still a little unusual for girls to be doing engineering.
We see this, it's similar to the glass ceiling people talk about, or the higher positions are just not, we don't have fair representations of the talents of the whole population. Which is interesting, you know, the day after we have our new ministers are appointing, we have parity for the first time in Canada. It'd be interesting if that trend continues to continue.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder as well, like for instance, I wonder if that's still people thinking, not considering that they could do engineering, or not getting the exposure to engineering young enough to realize that that's something that they could do as well. It's very difficult really to talk about it with any kind of solid authority, because it's not a viewpoint I hold. You know, it's not something that I can even really identify with, the notion that because of someone's gender they can't do X or Y job. I can't understand that idea. And so I don't even really particularly notice it. It's only when it's pointed out to me that everybody you see in this particular building is always a boy, then it even occurs to me, because it's not on my mind.
Sure.
But clearly this is something that's still happening, and it's a shame. So whenever we see people who are successful in areas that are not expected for whatever reason, then we have to obviously be very pleased that those those, if I might say, false barriers are coming down.
Yeah, I agree. And it is a fantastically rich area that many new positions are being established around the world in the area of exoplanet research. We have, what is it, 20 years ago when the first exoplanets were confirmed, and now just about 2,000 confirmed, plus maybe 4,000 or so waiting confirmation. It's just such a wealth of new data, planetary systems, trying to, and this is really helping people like Hooker who are looking and interested in the process of formation. So you can see all the various processes, and she had some interesting thoughts about how we got to this stage. She was talking about the hot Jupiters, yeah,
and the migration and. The migration of planets from the outer solar system to the inner solar system, or vice versa, and also about the planets we don't seem to see in our solar system. So the small Neptunes, was it the small Neptunes as well? So the hot Jupiters and the small Neptunes. So it's very
super Earths.
Are very intriguing ideas about. Yep. Planetary formation, about how we've ended up with this system configuration in our solar system.
I've always been fascinated with the Titius-Bode law, you know, the mathematical relationship for the distances, and how, because there was this mathematical pattern, they then found that there were some positions where there wasn't anything. And that was used to find Ceres, and then later for Uranus and Neptune. They basically assumed that that's the position, and then they just tried to find where it was on the orbit, and in order to also to explain the variations in the orbit of Saturn. I think it's going to be interesting. I've seen some suggestion that there are similar relations in other planetary systems, and hopefully that will have some bearing. Maybe it'd be nice to see if it is related to the actual formation process.
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice looking at these kinds of subjects, because when you talk about what you see going on out there, and then being able to relate that to back here, then it sets forth all kinds of questions in your mind, very interesting questions, and you can end up thinking about that for a while.
And the technology that's been used, Kepler's been fantastic with the vast majority of planetary detections actually from Kepler data, and it's still going. But we've got these wonderful techniques where you detect a planet from the transit timings as it passes in front of the star, but then slight variations in the transit timing can be used to detect a second planet, which is either slightly ahead or slightly behind, and so creating these slight variations. And we're getting detections because of these variations of planets that we can't see.
You can't see, exactly.
But we can tell that they're pretty similar to the way Uranus and Neptune were discovered originally.
Yeah.
So I find it a fascinating area, and it's great to have a visit with people like Dr. Schifting and find out more about it.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and featured an interview by co-host Tony Martinez. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Tony Martinez, and John Kissy. Our editors were John Kissy and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWCPSX, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough in time to join us again right here next time on Western Worlds. Thank you.